Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more podcasts about movies and nostalgia, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, a podcast where we revisit beloved pieces of pop culture from our youth to see if it's still as good all grown up. I'm Kara Gail O'Regan, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Jordan Poland Clark.
Hello.
And with us today is our guest, my good friend, Rob Guzio.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm all right.
Thanks for having me.
Rob picked the 1991 Steven Spielberg film Hook, which stars Robin Williams and explores the question posed by the film's tagline, "What if Peter Pan grew up?"
Oh, you gave away the tagline really early.
Well, what? It's the whole premise of the movie. What else am I going to do?
Sometimes that's a game you make us play later, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, not this time. Right. Anyway, the film follows his character, Peter Banning, as he reconnects with his past as Peter Pan in order to save his children from Captain Hook, played by Dustin Hoffman. Rob, why did you choose this movie?
I was thinking about that. I don't know if I have a great answer other than it was, it immediately came into my mind when you mentioned, you know, me being a possible guest. It was the very first thing I thought of, and it just felt really right. But, you know, it was an important movie in my childhood. And I feel like it was sort of probably something that stunted my growth in some ways because it started a literal Peter Pan syndrome in me for many years. In general, I guess I wanted to also talk about it because I feel like it gets a bad rap nowadays and I don't understand why. And I was hoping maybe we could get to the bottom of it together.
Oh, we can get to the bottom of it. All right. Because I get why it gets a bad rap. But, Jordan, had you seen this movie before?
No, never. I remember being, like, 6 or 7 and, like, knowing that everybody else was watching this movie, and I never saw it.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't know. I just think it was, like, I want to say it was, like, because I was at the age where, like, if my parents didn't want to watch it with me or if, like, one of my best friends didn't, like, show it to me at their house, I wouldn't see it because I had no control over what I did or didn't see. But we've talked about this before on the podcast, too, where there's, like, a bunch of stuff that we've watched that were, like, why did I see that when I was 6? So, like, I don't know. I just never saw it.
Yeah. I definitely saw it, but I think I, like, was maybe at a sleepover or something where I, like, wandered away during the first 10 minutes and then came back during the fight scene because that was the only part that I actually remembered.
Like the last fight scene?
Yeah, the one at the end. So This was mostly new to me, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's interesting that this was one of the first things that came to mind when I was explaining the premise of the show because that has been the case for a lot of the guys that I've talked to about this show. Like, one of the first things that they say is Hook, at least the men that are of our generation. Oh. And I feel like this is a very boy movie and like wasn't
true.
So much like something that like was very girly. So yeah,
I see. I never
I
thought
think
of
that's
it that way.
True. And I even felt that now, like, like, even just watching it, like, I couldn't deal with the color scheme. Is that because I'm trained as a girl? Like, do boys not mind that color scheme and all that, like, busyness?
Whoa. Well, I'm trying to think of, like, what I would define the color scheme as. I feel like it's very,
brown.
Like, golden and, like, beige.
Yeah, there's a lot of browns, which is really funny that you say that because my boyfriend is, like, very into brown and is about to buy a brown car with brown interior. it was a lot of browns and then blacks and reds, I think, is probably the dominant color scheme. So, pretty masculine. Also, there are, like, very few women in the movie.
Like, yeah, and
in general.
They're all in the beginning, and then they just abandon them all. Even the little girl, they make the whole subplot, or not, I guess it's not really a subplot, but, like, Peter's kids are not in it all that much. And mm-hmm. But even the plot that the kids get has just the boy becoming a mini Captain Hook and the girl doing squat, right?
Yeah, she kind of gets sidelined a little bit. And it definitely becomes a more of a father-son story. And, like, you're like, what about your daughter, too? Like, why is the son, like, so much more important to you than...
Well, because it's a Steven Spielberg movie, and he's always trying to work out the issues that he had with his own father.
That is very true. This is totally on brand for him.
Yeah.
But also, I you know...
this is a Steven Spielberg movie. It's not good like the other ones.
Well, you know...
How dare you?
They haven't all been great. You know, there were some misses along the way.
More recently, I feel like there's been a lot of people critically saying that he's kind of lost his edge a little bit and that he's not churning out the hits like he used to. But I remember even before that, like when he was still on like his hot streak, people would say that this was his flop, like his one flop.
Yeah, and he doesn't even like it.
Which oh, really?
He's like kind of embarrassed by it, yeah.
Why though? I'm legitimately asking. I mean, I have never heard any specifics about like why certain people don't like it or why it's like considered not worthy of the canon.
I'm going to read you. So I wanted to also, I knew that I didn't like it, but I couldn't pinpoint why. So I Googled Roger Ebert's review of it because I knew that I would agree with him and I knew that he would have better words for it than me. So there's one paragraph of it that I wanted to read because I think he really nailed it. But of course I didn't have it pulled up, so now I have to find it.
There were aspects of it that I did really like. Like, the pirate set was really great.
Yeah.
I think that that had, like, kind of Spielberg-level production quality. But that was kind of, like, limited to just that one aspect. I didn't really like anything else about it.
The sets were very... it felt like a theme park ride.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think I even said that while we were watching it, that, like, I could see this being, like, a section of Disney World or something.
Oh, that's what this more looks like to me than a movie. Like, this looks like when you go to Universal Studios and they're like, go on the Jurassic Park ride. Like, that's what this looks like.
Yeah, and it was all, like... built on a sound stage, and it was pretty small, I think, because they wound up using like a fisheye lens a lot to make it seem bigger than it was, which made me really nauseous. But
I found the paragraph I really like.
Oh yeah, go for it.
He says, after the children disappear and Peter finds Hook's kidnap note and is told by Granny Wendy who he really is and why he must follow, I was poised for a breathtaking first view of Neverland, but what I got was a dreary disappointment. The long, long, long Neverland sequences take place in a cluttered rag-and-bone shop of art direction. There are too many characters, too many props, too many signs, too many costumes, bad traffic direction, and no sense of place or space. The whole thing looks like what it is, a movie set, right down to the unconvincing backdrops, and for some reason there's a shift to red and brown in the color spectrum, so Neverland, which in my imagination at least is on a lush green island, looks as if it's in the midst of a drought.
Wow.
That really nailed it for me.
Yeah, that's literally what you said. That's crazy.
But, like, I can get how if you saw this when you were, like, really small, like, none of that would matter.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, I guess... It has that kind of thing where when you're little, everything seems huge. And, like, you know, child actors that are pretty bad also don't seem as bad. And, you know.
Oh, I thought the kids in this were great, actually. Especially the kid that played Robin Williams' son. He was, like, incredible. But anyway,
he became the kid in Can't Hardly Wait who goes, yes. I can't feel my legs. I can't feel my legs. Didn't he?
Yeah, I think so, but now he's a lawyer.
Wow. So he literally became what Peter Banning was in the movie. So maybe he's going to have some kind of a renaissance where he like goes back to being an actor and it's like
Oh, I hope so. I found him just like captivating and I was like really disappointed that he didn't continue acting.
Well, you should check out his part in Can't Hardly Wait for his true moment of glory.
I really liked the lost boy who had a really thick New York accent and looked like he was like maybe 50 years old.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I liked him a lot.
He's definitely in other movies of the era, that kid. It's not the kid from Dick Tracy, right?
I don't know. I don't know who the kid from Dick Tracy is.
I think that's probably another boy movie.
It is, yeah. What other boy movies are there? Tell us about them. We didn't watch them.
Oh, geez. Around this time? Well, I don't know. I can't think of any, like, I wasn't into, I had a cousin who was, like, into, like, action movies and horror movies before those were really appropriate to watch. Like, he used to make me watch Nightmare on Elm Street, and it used to literally terrify me to my core.
That's too scary.
It was way too scary for me at the time. And I used to, like, freak out when my parents were like, we're going to Michael's house, because I'd be like, no, he's going to make me watch the scary movies. But, you know, then there was Hook, where I was, you know, pretending to fly around the house, and I would like try to like, I think I might have tried to put on like my mom's like pantyhose to like replicate the stockings.
So you identified more with Peter Pan necessarily than like with the Lost Boys.
Yes, absolutely. I think I was thinking about this, like where it came from, because I don't remember ever really being into the Disney animated Peter Pan, which is I think how a lot of children born after, you know, 1950 would know about Peter Pan. I don't really think I liked that so much. It was actually the Kathy Rigby live Peter Pan musical that I used to watch when I was a kid. My mom used to rent it for me, and I think I used to like wear the tape out. I would just rent it over and over again. Have you guys ever seen this?
Yes, we were just watching scenes of it.
Oh, that's what you were watching?
It has to be the same one, right? Hold on, I'm going to see if there's more than one. Yeah, that's what I was watching. I was just watching clips of it before we started recording, because I also watched it like on repeat constantly.
It was so good. And
I remembered while watching Hook that I actually played Peter Pan once.
What?
And had, like, almost no, like, I had completely erased it from my brain prior to watching this movie. It was, like, during a summer camp thing, and I had one song as Peter Pan, and I skipped a verse and then got to the verse after that and then realized that I didn't have words, and then I panicked. And it was in that moment that I realized that, like, maybe I'm more of a behind-the-scenes kind of person than a get-up-on-stage-and-do-things kind of person.
So
were you when that happened?
Maybe, like, 10 or 11. I don't know.
So you were, like, the kid in the beginning of Hook where they have to feed her the lines.
Yeah, basically.
While the play is happening.
Yeah.
What? So amateur.
Those kids are really good, though. I was in Peter Pan when I was probably like 9 at camp, but I was just in the chorus. But I did, when I was like 6 or 7, sing a song from Cinderella as the fairy godmother dressed in a Tinkerbell costume, which I also screwed up. And I did a similar thing, although not as bad. Like, yours sounds really very embarrassing.
It was.
Did you just stand there when you had no more words left?
No, I walked around, like, kind of with my arms out, pretending to look confident, and hummed along.
Nice alpha move.
Oh, tell me there's a video of that.
Oh God, I hope not. And then picked it back up in the chorus. And then afterwards, everyone was like, "No, I barely noticed." And I was like, "Yeah, okay, all right. That is a load of shit, but okay. Thanks for trying to make me feel better."
I did basically the opposite thing, which is that I sang the Bippity Boppity Boo song, and at the end of it, you have to repeat Bippity Boppity, like 8 times or something, and I could never remember how many times it was, so I knew I was going to get it wrong, and I did it like 1 or 2 too many times. The music stopped, and I was still singing. But the woman who ran our plays, like, I was remembering, like, when they had the play at the beginning of this movie, and the woman running it was feeding them the lines. They were still really, really, really good. The woman who ran our plays had a microphone on a stick that she held up to the stage as she fed us our lines. So it was, like, not slick at all.
Well, you gotta work with what you got.
All right, so Rob.
Yeah.
What parts of this still felt good to you while you watched it?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I was just watching clips on YouTube because I've seen the movie pretty recently, and I remember it. It's like in my DNA. Like I can't. Like I know every beat. Like every like literal like musical cue in it.
Yeah.
So. Going from my most recent viewing, the stuff that still felt really good to me, I mean, I love, immediately I think of, like, the scenes where he, like, actually becomes Peter Pan at the end, and it's really in, like, the last, like, 20 minutes of the movie that he finally, like, flies.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a really long time to get there.
Yeah, and I remember sort of being, as a kid, like, bored by the Peter Banning parts of the movie, but at the same time, like, I guess the Lost Boys portion and Rufio and all that, it does kind of it carries it a little bit, but I do look back now and I'm like, wow, he doesn't become Peter Pan till really the very, very end. But that scene where he does and he's flying and he's in the outfit still like makes me really happy. What else? The food fight scene is incredible. I feel like that is a reference point that a lot of people who saw the movie as kids make, and that scene where it's like, you know, the food is kind of revealed where it's imaginary and then all of a sudden it's real, and it's really just like looks like, I don't know, like frosting? Just
it's
bowls
not
of frosting?
Food.
I was going to say colored diarrhea, but sure. Bowls of frosting works too.
But like for some reason, when you're a kid and like all you eat is candy, like I did, that was like, I was like, whatever that is, I want it because it's probably really good. It's probably the kind of stuff that I would never be allowed to eat, but it looks amazing. And also, I thought, spoilers, Rufio's death was really affecting to me.
Yeah.
I thought, again, much like the kid who plays Jack, Rufio as an actor, I really wish he did more stuff. It's a shame
because
he's fantastic.
Yeah, I also really liked Rufio.
I did too.
I feel like just by saying this, I might like will it into being, like the Hollywood producers are listening at this moment, but I feel like if they're ever to make a sequel.
They definitely are.
I Googled him yesterday and I read an article, I don't know how true it is or not, I'll Google it again, that said that he is working with someone to do a Rufio spinoff project. But now I know that Rufio's dead, I'm not sure about that.
But that calls into question, like, how, maybe, like, the Lost Boys supposedly don't age, right? If they're in Neverland, like, nobody ages?
Yeah, I have questions about this.
I
the
think
rules
as long
are
as
very
they stay
hazy.
In Neverland, nobody ages. But if they, like, go into normal land,
but
they do?
But there's a okay, Peter, like, 75% of the way into the movie, Peter, like, gets his memory back. and remembers his mother, even though he was like 6 months old in the memory. There's no way he could remember his mother. Yeah, yeah. But he rolls away from her.
Yeah, and he says that he wanted to get away.
He wanted to get away because he was scared to die. But also he was a 6 month old baby in a stroller. But fine, whatever. So he rolls down a hill and out of his stroller, and he's laying on the ground, and Tinkerbell comes and takes him away. Right? That's what happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so he's a baby when she takes him away. So he had to age.
Interesting point. Yeah.
That made me angry. I didn't like that.
Also, did you notice
that... You might be applying a little too much logic to this.
No, but, I think that's warranted. We have to figure this out, you guys. did you notice that when he returns to Wendy throughout, you know, sort of, they do like a time jump each time he comes back to her. One of the times it's Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, it was.
Or is that,
right?
No, or am I thinking of when it's
Wendy's?
No, Wendy's?
It is her. Yeah, it was her second film appearance.
She's definitely in it, but I might be misremembering that it's actually, it's when he sees Moira and he goes and Wendy's, you know, Maggie Smith, and she's like, it's my granddaughter, and it's Gwyneth Paltrow sleeping on Beatles sheets. I told you, I don't mess around with Hook.
Yeah, that whole granddaughter.
We did not like
thing.
That part.
Well, it made me uncomfortable.
That's messaged fair. Kara, like, right. He was like, I must kiss her. One, she's like 8. Two, she's like asleep. Three, her grandma's right there being like, yeah, do it, Peter. Like, all of it was so weird.
It's so weird because he says, I'll give her a kiss, and she's like, no thimbles, no needles.
That was weird, like, too.
It's like, that's the one that's worse for you?
I didn't, yeah. Like, she had none of, she, ugh. The,
how I wrote down, all this kiss-giving business is weird.
So the girl's asleep, Peter's like, I'm gonna kiss her. And Wendy was like, no thimbles, because it'll break her heart when she learns she can't keep you. Like, let her make her own decisions. Get out of here. Maybe she won't even like him at all. Like, what are you talking about?
But, I mean, to be honest, though, Peter Pan is the ultimate fuckboy.
Truly. Truly he is. Yes.
Peter Pan syndrome. It's aptly named.
So true. I found seeing Robin Williams as like angry business dad was like really upsetting to me.
I did too. I didn't like it at all. He was so horrible.
Yeah. I was like, oh, no wonder I probably wandered out of the room when this happened. It's like upsetting.
I, as an adult, like between that, like he was so nasty to his kids, and between that and like all of the pirates being like straight up adults who were like, we murdered children. I was like, what? Like, that's not that weird when it's like a cartoon, or even like in the live action version that I grew up watching, it didn't feel scary like that. Like, Captain Hook wasn't actually scary in that. He didn't look scary, and it was so over the top that it wasn't upsetting to me as a kid, but, like, this was upsetting.
Oh, I found David Crosby very distracting in the pirate scenes.
Oh, my God.
He just, like, stuck out like a sore thumb to me. But apparently, Jimmy Buffett was also one of the pirates.
And Glenn Close.
As was Glenn Close.
Glenn Close was the boo box.
Didn't even realize that was her.
That was, like, pretty stellar makeup for such a weird, like, random, unnecessary cameo. Yeah, but going back to what you're saying about, like, it being dark and sort of, like, scary, I think that's really why I liked it as a kid, because I was into... I feel like that was a Spielberg thing, or, like, sort of an Amblin thing, where it was fantastical and silly, but also there was, like, a real danger to it and a darkness. Like, thinking about, like, Gremlins or, like, the Goonies... and I think maybe he pushed it a little too far for, like, the material. Like, people were expecting super lighthearted, and they got this like family drama, and but I don't know, that stuff didn't bother me when I was a kid. I liked Captain Hook. I thought, like, you know, it felt real enough to me, and for some reason I just overlooked the boring, like, grown-up parts of it. Can we talk about Maggie Smith?
Sure.
She looks older in this than she does now.
Yeah. She's in old makeup.
This was like 30 years ago.
I know. Yeah. She's been playing a crone for 30 years.
But this has totally warped my, like, perception of her, because I thought she was like 95 years old in 1991. And so I'm just looking at her, I'm like, you're immortal. You can never die.
I mean, she might be.
You became a vampire at age 95. When they shot this. What? You're kidding.
I mean, she was great in this, but why didn't they cast, like, just an actual old lady? An older woman?
Yeah. I don't know.
She's good in it. I don't care. But, like, if they're gonna do that, why wouldn't they... Ugh, whatever. I don't even... Just choose one actress and age her with makeup and have one... I don't even care. Whatever.
There was a lot of makeup choices in this movie. From the Glenn Close thing to... Also, like, Robin Williams, like, I feel like they just stuffed a pillow under his shirt, and they're like, you're middle-aged.
Well, he was kind of, he was, like, a little bit chubby at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then when he was Peter Pan, he looked super skinny.
Well, he has an extended workout montage.
Yeah, that 3-day workout montage.
Oh, I must have blocked that out.
Yeah, because Tinkerbell, like, negotiates with Captain Hook and is like, give me 3 days.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know? And then it's like, workout montage.
And then he emerges in full Peter Pan costume and eyeliner. In basically...
Another choice.
From 1 second to the next, he completely transforms into old Peter Pan.
Do you guys think that Fruit Ninja came from this movie?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Because he was, like, clearly the original Fruit Ninja.
Does he chop a lot of fruit in this?
No, but, like, there's the one scene, like, right at the end of the food fight where Rufio throws a coconut at him and he, like, gets his sword. Someone tosses him his sword. And so instead of getting, like, hit in the head with the coconut, he slices it right in half. Like, it's exactly Fruit Ninja.
It's a really slow-moving coconut, too, because in the time it's thrown, there's enough time for one of the lost boys to be like, Peter, look out! Here's your sword! Still coming! Coconuts! Coconuts still coming!
I had a lot of problem with, like, a lot of, like, fake physics things in this movie, where I was like, that's not how that person would fall from that. Like, that's not what flying would look like. Like, I had a hard time with some of the stunts.
Which sounds ridiculous, but Jordan's actually an acrobat, so she knows these things.
Are you really?
Yeah. I mean, I also just, like, in general, am really appreciative of good stunts, and this was not that.
Mm. There's a lot of very obvious wire work happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just, it looked sloppy.
There was a good IMDb trivia about the stunt people, and I didn't copy it down, so I'm going to look at it real quick.
I will say, while you're looking it up, that a lot of it reminded me of Home Alone. Like, that's what it looked like, was when Macaulay Culkin is, like, beating up those two bad guys. It was, like, the same kind of stunts, except in Home Alone, it's kind of supposed to be, like, cartoony, and maybe this was, too, but that's not how it felt like it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Well...
That final battle when they're fighting the pirates and they're in those, like, crazy homemade armor outfits.
There's a lot those of outfits. Like,
those were
they're
those
really
are
cool
so
outfits.
Good.
But there's a lot of, like, Ewok style fighting where they're basically like, throwing twigs and rocks at them, and it's like killing the pirates. And meanwhile, the pirates have, like, guns and swords.
Yeah. So both Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams stunt doubles were in. Both of them were named Keith.
That was so worth the wait.
I know, right? But wait, it gets better. When Steven Spielberg called for Keith to come to set, both Keiths showed up. So eventually, Hoffman's stunt double changed his name from Keith to Kifo.
Kifo?
Mm-hmm.
What? Why not, like, Heath or...
Just a different name?
Carl, yeah, something totally different.
Kifo. Like a name that doesn't rhyme with the name you're trying not to sound like.
Keitho. Maybe they shot this in Australia. That sounds like an Australia thing.
Oh, that does sound like an Australian thing.
Keitho.
They actually shot it entirely on a soundstage in Culver City, California.
Oh, good. They didn't have to travel far.
Yeah. So we haven't yet talked about Tinkerbell.
Oh, let's.
No, or Dustin Hoffman, really. But yeah, we got to talk to Tinkerbell.
We'll get to him. I had some qualms about Tinkerbell, played by Julia Roberts, who looks amazing with short hair.
Yeah,
didn't know.
Yeah, she was miscast in this. I didn't like
yeah,
her.
She was very poorly utilized. Apparently, Carrie Fisher was Steven Spielberg's original prototype for Tinkerbell.
Oh, she would have
sure
been great.
They couldn't get her. Yeah. She actually did an uncredited rewriting of the final draft of the screenplay.
Whoa.
But, yeah.
Why?
Who knows?
Oh my god, but, that's mind-blowing. I want to know, like, what parts are Carrie Fisher?
I know, right? Well, Spielberg actually nicknamed Julia Roberts Tinker Hell because she was apparently difficult to work with because he had her, like, sequestered the whole time performing in solitude against a green screen.
Yeah, you can really tell.
Yeah, and apparently he was, like, a real dick to her the whole time, which really sucks.
Man, I did not... Wow, that's crazy. I usually think of him as being, like, so kindly.
Yeah, apparently not on the set of this. He also had a hard time with the Lost Boys, who were apparently quite rebellious. And he said of that time... Or he said of working with Julia Roberts in that movie that it was an unfortunate time for us to work together, which I think translates to I was going through some shit and yeah. I took it out on other people.
Yeah, don't that, you also, yeah. like, you can't put a bunch of, like, small boys together and then be like, oh, they misbehaved. Of course yeah. they did.
Was this before or after Jurassic Park?
This was before Jurassic Park.
2 years before?
It's like, mm-hmm. it might have been right before, right? Like, it was maybe the movie
Jurassic
he did
Park
prior.
Was 93.
Yeah.
And this was 91. So, I think it was either the movie he made before Jurassic Park or two before. Because that alligator at the end is a real, like, just popped out to me as, like, a real prototype for a Jurassic Park dinosaur.
True. I wonder if he was doing, because Jurassic Park took like 4 years for pre-production because they were doing like basically inventing the technology and they almost filmed a lot of the movie with like puppets and then scrapped a lot of it. And I wonder if he was like working on early Jurassic Park stuff and was just his heart was not in this.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely could be the case, because Industrial Light and Magic did the effects for Jurassic Park and also did this movie, so it wouldn't be...
They're, like, shockingly different. I mean, I know, like, it's a couple of years apart, but, like, any special effects that happen in this are so bad.
Yeah, there's not much going on special effects-wise.
But even just, like, with green screen stuff. Actually, the Tinkerbell stuff wasn't bad. I don't remember. There was something else that I was just like, oh, gross. It looked terrible.
I don't know. Tinkerbell was a little too flashy and made my brain have a migraine.
What do you guys feel about, like, just, I mean, her character? What does Tinkerbell mean to you guys?
I, I don't know. Jordan, you go first.
I think it's annoying to have the only woman who's in this movie because, like, they threw away all the other women who were in it. They left them at home, or they, like, kind of just discarded the little girl. But Tink actually stays in the movie for the most part. And I think it's annoying to have the only woman in the movie be the one who's, like, momming everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. There's nothing wrong with her except for she's the only one and that's what she's doing.
Yeah, her entire role is to take care of.
And that doesn't track with the Tinkerbell of, like, you know, every other Peter Pan adaptation, yeah. Where she's the opposite of the mothering one. Like, Wendy is the mothering one, and she's the one who's kind of, like, out of control and rebellious and more like mm-hmm. a lost boy.
Yeah, I did and not appreciate only, that.
I don't like that she loves Peter Pan either.
Oh, that to me was so inappropriate. The fact that, like, once she turns into, like, a normal-sized person, her hair grows out.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, she has, like, long hair all of a sudden. And I'm like, what? The best part about this movie was Julia Roberts with short hair, and now you're going to have her have, like, long hair?
I didn't like that. She seems kind of, like, dumb. Like, like, emotionally dumb. Not like, I mean, I guess she's a fairy or whatever. Like, maybe her emotional capabilities are different than that of humans. I don't know anything about fairies. But, like, and it kind of works when she's a small fairy. You're like, okay, fine, this is your character. But then I found it to be really weird and off-putting when she was big.
Yeah.
I agree that she was, that Julia Roberts was miscast, because I feel like that probably has a lot to do with why she feels emotionally dumb. We're so used to seeing Julia Roberts play the characters that are, like, super smart and witty and, like, cunning and, like, driven. And in this movie, she's basically, like, the jilted, like, ex-lover, but not really. and all her motivation is, like, just, like, helping Peter. And but then really, she doesn't really give a crap about his kids or anything.
Yeah, she doesn't. It's just a very weird role. During the food scene, though, when they're eating, and she's sitting there, and she's, like, watching this all happen, but not participating in it. And I was like, oh, Jordan's not going to like this.
Which part?
In the,
say it again.
The scene when they're all sitting around the table, and they've, like, manifested their imaginary food into real food, and they're all, like, enjoying it, and she's just sitting there alone, like, observing and not actually participating.
She just threw a couple of Julia Roberts laughs in there.
Yeah.
I didn't like when she did the Julia Roberts laugh. I just assumed it was because she's a fairy and she doesn't eat.
Well, whoa. So we had that conversation too, and then she does eat something, so yeah. That is not the case.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, they keep her, like, very, very separate from mm-hmm. them, which is, you know, exactly my problem with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was what I meant when I said, oh, Jordan's not going to like this. Did you know that because she was so often in the air, Julia Roberts had an assistant whose sole responsibility was to clean her feet?
Oh, my God. That's real. When, like, if you're, like, performing, like, I mean, I guess not in dance as much, but, like, in circus you go barefoot a lot. So the best thing to do is you keep, like, a pumice stone, because then you can scrape, like, the whole layer of skin off so your feet look clean. Because nobody, like, if you bring dirty feet on a stage, that's all anyone's going to look at.
Yeah.
If you have dirty feet or if you almost have a wedgie. Like, no one will see anything else that you do.
I wonder if she had an assistant to pick her wedgie.
Anyway, so that's real.
Yeah.
That's fair. That Tinkerbell analysis is definitely fair. Now, watching it now, it's very obvious that there were some limitations in how they made that character real. Like, nowadays, they would just make her a CGI character, and they'd probably mm-hmm. be able to do so much more with her. But, like, having her like basically on a separate stage. She's not interacting with the actors, and anytime you see her in the world of the movie, she's just a flashlight beam, basically. There's like very little effect done to like make it feel real.
What was Tinkerbell like in the other two? I mean, I know there was more than two other Peter Pans, but I've only ever seen two, the cartoon and the live action like musical one. Mm-hmm. So in the musical, there wasn't really a Tinkerbell. She was just like a light, right?
Yeah, like an actual flashlight.
Yeah, so that's, we can't even really judge her as a character. She was literally just a light, so okay, fine. What was she like in the animated one? Because I don't remember.
She's definitely one of the most hateable characters in all of fiction.
Oh my gosh, why?
She's terrible. She tries to murder Wendy on multiple occasions, and she lies about it, and she basically gaslights everyone in Neverland.
I feel like that, like, I don't remember her at all from it, but just hearing you describe it like that, and then, like, looking at pictures of her, and she looks, like, so cute and innocent, that makes me like her more.
Well, she's psychotic, and also she, I remember watching, like, a Disney documentary about animation, and they based her on Marilyn Monroe.
Her
character model, and like, if she had a motto, it would be, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best. That's her whole MO throughout the Peter Pan saga. She's insufferable. And I almost would have appreciated it more if they went for that here, but instead it just felt like they couldn't pull out of the Julie Roberts like gravitational pull of her being, you know, America's sweetheart at the time.
Well, she wasn't quite the Julia Roberts that we know and love now. She had been in Pretty Woman and like one other movie, maybe also Steel Magnolias and Mystic Pizza. So, okay, that's like a few movies, but
she was about to become mega famous.
Yeah. I read this profile of her from Vanity Fair from like 1999, in which she talks about her experience on the film very briefly, and basically said, "I felt like betrayed by Spielberg." But in 1999 was like really, I think, the height of her crazy fame, and I don't generally make a habit of like comparing myself to other people and what they've accomplished in their life, but seeing as I am about to turn 31 and she was 31 in that profile, she was making $20 million a movie at the age of 31, and I was like, yikes.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. Yikes. If only I could make $20 million.
There's still time. Maybe you'll make $20 million a podcast.
Yeah, $20 million a podcast.
Dream big.
Yeah, we're getting a couple mil for this one, right?
Joey and Mike. So, we haven't yet talked about the title character, who Hook. I was surprised he wasn't in the movie more.
I'm glad he wasn't, though. Wait, can I ask a question about him before we start talking about him? Because I don't want to forget. Because I asked it out loud when it happened. At the end, his wig gets pulled off. And I feel like that was, you know, to make all the little kids go like, hee-hee-hee-hee-hee. Because he was like, has all gray hair underneath.
But he's just an old man with no mommy or whatever the line is.
Does that mean that his eyebrows and his mustache are also fake?
interesting question.
That's my number one question about him.
I think that they are heavily affected. I think they're dyed, and and we see him putting his own earwax.
Oh my god, it was so gross.
I want to see that movie of like Captain Hook's self-care regimen.
There's a surprising amount of it in the movie. There's like Smee is like really tending to him and like really
he's kind of a diva.
Yeah, so I read an interesting thing about Hook and Smee. In an interview with Playboy in 2004, Dustin Hoffman recalled his aha moment with Bob Hoskins, who played Smee, about their characters actually being gay, which I found interesting and did not at all pick up on.
I could buy that. Why not?
Apparently, they decided to play their characters as quote, a couple of old queens because they felt, poor choice of words, but they felt J.M. Barrie, the progenitor of Peter Pan, had created them that way. Bob and I, quote, Bob and I were rehearsing, and suddenly we looked up at each other and realized it at the same time. We said, these guys are gay, and it was fun. Suddenly, we rehearsed it that way. Get over here, Smee. Give me a foot massage.
He does.
We went to Spielberg, and he said, this is a kid's movie. And suddenly, it made all the sense in the world. They were really good friends. They lived on a ship. They were devoted to each other. End quote.
It's true, though. There are no women in Neverland, right? Like,
there are, like, prostitutes. And there's Glenn Close. Like,
that's a different movie.
Yeah. Speaking of a different movie, apparently David Bowie turned down the role of Captain Hook.
And I would
have loved to see that. Yeah.
I as much as I love Dustin Hoffman in the role, that would have been truly something. I mean, I feel like we could look at Labyrinth as like a sort of somewhat close. He's like a Captain Hook type character in that, right?
Yeah.
I always liked the scenes with him and Smee. I thought that their banter, I still think it's like, it holds up. It's really funny. Like when he's like threatening to kill himself and he's like, I'm going to do it. Don't try to stop me. Don't try to stop me. Try to stop me, please. What are you doing? Try to stop me. He's literally like such a diva and so dramatic. And Smee is like, it's another like ambiguously gay relationship, like Smithers and Mr. Burns.
Oh yeah, I didn't make that connection, but you're right.
I wish that like they then would have taken his like love for drama like even more over the top then. Like, yeah, I don't know. That would have made it more fun. Or maybe I just need to go back and watch it with that lens on.
Yeah, I feel like it definitely would change things for me.
I think it's in there. Like, he puts on the whole show of the baseball game, and it's clearly like...
But I guess... yeah, no, that's definitely true. Like, he puts on a whole production of a baseball game.
And he kills a guy for not playing along in the right way.
Yeah, that's true. I just, like, I didn't read it that way when I was watching it. I was just like, why is this happening? But, because then I was, yeah, it's because it was making me have, like, more logistical questions. Because he, like, spends all this time trying to win this kid over. But, like, in Neverland, kids don't age, so he was always going to be a kid. So what, you get one kid pirate, and then everyone else is an adult, and then how did the pirates become adults? I was just struggling with that.
Yeah, there's a lot of magical realism jumps that one has to make with this movie.
I also, like, had a struggle because I think that this movie expects that you remember more of the plot of Peter Pan than I actually did.
Yeah, I definitely. Think you're right about
and they
that.
Didn't. Definitely. They didn't feed me any details that were helpful.
Yeah, and like, and a lot of it, as I got older, I realized it was coming not from, like, the Disney movie, but from straight up, like, the J.M. Barrie books. And I didn't read those until I was, like, 14 or 15. Or I guess I just read that one.
Cause like what was the clock thing? I know that that's a thing, but I can't remember what it is.
The alligator that bit his hand off first 8 o'clock, I guess. And so as it got closer to him, he could hear it ticking.
It was ticking. Yeah, I guess I do remember that.
Yeah, but it's also, it's weird because the crocodile is massive. And it's just supposed to be a normal, regular crocodile that bites his hand off. But in this movie, it's like 20 feet tall. And it is dead and stuffed, but yet it eats him and then burps.
Oh, that's supposed to be the real alligator?
Yeah, that was the one. He says at one point in the movie, in the beginning, he's like, that's why I stuffed it and I had it on display for everyone to see.
Did not pick up on that.
Like, dinosaur large.
Yeah, well, that's why I said it was like a real prototype for Jurassic Park.
And when it, spoiler alert, when it kills him at the end, it just falls on him. It doesn't. Yeah.
And it falls even on a him, shot of and he's it, like, gone. Not killing him. Like, he's just in the middle of the mouth.
And then and they're like, Hook's gone. And then you just hear burp. Like, is it alive? Like, what's happening? I was confused by that, even as a kid. I wasn't buying it.
Yeah. It's a great example of problematic disability representation in film, because we don't often see disabled characters, and so often when we do, they fall into like one of a very few categories, one of which is that like evil character, and that somehow their mm-hmm. like disability, like not to use a pun, but hooks in with their evilness. I don't have much more to say about that. I just wanted to point it out.
Well, pirates are, that's true. Like a pirate's trope at this point. Like, yeah, I feel it is like pirates are the originators trope. Of those yeah. bad stereotypes.
I mean.
But is that real? Like, is that just because, like, pirates tended to lose hands or feet or legs? Maybe that's just an accurate representation of pirates. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know any pirates either. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar enough with the trope and like the history of disability representation in fiction to really like say that that's where that comes from. But it certainly shows up a lot.
Yeah.
In literature and film and other stuff. But Captain Hook's actual hook was largely designed by Steven Spielberg. And the production designer Norman Garwood and Amblin's prop master Mark Wade. And it was made by Burbank blacksmith Tony Swatton. And then he was charged with physically crafting several versions. But some of them were actually made of rubber for the fight scenes. So that no one actually, you know, lost an eye or something.
I remember having one of those, a rubber hook. It must really? Have been. It must have been like when this was out.
Was it like ornate? Did it have like the filigree on it, like it has in the movie?
No. It was just like it wasn't fancy at all. It was just like had a black part that like had a handle on the inside, and then it was like a gray hook. Yeah,
that's a classic Halloween hook right there.
Yeah,
for sure. I definitely used to play with that.
I'm pretty sure I had like the movie licensed. Hook toy. There were a lot of toys from this movie. Maybe that's also why I remember it so fondly, but I remember having like a coloring book, and I had the sword, the Peter Pan sword, and the hook, and maybe some action figures too.
Was the hook from this movie like fancier than the black and gray one?
Yeah, it was supposed to look like the
one. Yeah, it was all like silver and nice.
Oh.
Yeah.
It wasn't like rubber and you can stab your friends with it.
It was
only some of them.
It was steel, and it was really sharp, and you could cut people with it. It was very, very irresponsible. I did like in the film how he like I liked that the idea that he'll switch his hooks and like have different like accessories, like a goblet. And, like, that felt so funny and goofy and like over the top, like he kind of is like he's like a dandy. He has like all these outfits and different like all of his decor is like little hooks. And his mustache is a hook.
Yeah, it was very off-brand, you know.
Just, yeah, his branding.
It's a strong sense of personal branding. Little Cage Club Podcast Network crossover. We recently recorded, though it will not be out for quite a while after this, for Watch the Throne, The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, which is a garbage movie. It's not good at all. But same production designer as Hook, which I found interesting.
I've never seen that, but it sounds like it would be very different from this.
Very different, but definitely much worse.
Whoa.
Had that.
I mean, the production design is fine in both of them, but overall, the movie was just not good at all.
Nope. Is that a Spielberg collaborator? The production design in this was bad.
I don't agree. I wouldn't say that it was like spectacular, but I think they clearly worked very hard on it. I'll put it that way.
Everybody who makes a movie works very hard on it.
That's true. The film originally had a shooting schedule of 76 days and a budget of $48 million, but production took much longer than expected.
Oh, can we guess how high the budget went?
Sure.
What'd you say was the original?
$48 million.
Oh,
I think
way
it
over.
Went to 75.
Ooh, good one. What do you think, Rob?
I was actually going to say 100 million.
Okay.
That's probably
so kind of right smack dab in the middle. It was 80 million.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
And it took 116 days, which was 40 more days than originally planned.
And how much did box office make?
I didn't write that part down.
Oh.
Hang on. But Spielberg mostly blamed himself, and he said that he began to work on it at a slower pace than he normally does. Hmm. So, take that for what it's worth. So, budget was, what did I say, 80 million?
It made money.
Yeah.
300 million.
Yeah, worldwide, 119 in the USA. It's not bad.
That was probably, and by Spielberg's standards, not good.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But also, I think it lived well as a VHS release as well.
Yeah.
In my house, it certainly did. Of the VHS.
Was Carrie Fisher in this?
So she and George Lucas actually have a cameo, a very brief cameo. Apparently, they're kissing. I didn't see them.
No.
I just read it in the IMDb trivia. But apparently, at some point, they're like a kissing couple that some fairy dust falls on.
Oh, man. That's weird to me. Do you think, like,
I find the idea of kissing George Lucas deeply distressing.
Yeah.
But that's just me.
Do you think that was his idea? He was like, maybe I could kiss Carrie.
Oh, for sure. And Spielberg was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, bro.
As he always says to George Lucas.
As always. Yep.
Oh, man. Poor Carrie Fisher.
I know. I miss her.
I bet you all the lines that are still funny in this movie were written by her.
That's what probably. I like to think. There was like a few times that I laughed. I bet she wrote those parts.
Yeah. There's some good, like, sarcastic Captain Hook stuff that I feel like is really right in her wheelhouse.
How about that cell phone that he had, though?
Oh, my
1991,
gosh.
That it was so small.
Nice cell phone for 1991. That's how you know he was important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like when
I actually
looked
it up. It cost $2,500 back then.
Oh, my gosh.
Holy cow.
You just threw it in the snow.
And that part in the beginning where they do, like, the duel, where they have, like, the holsters, and they pull out their phones, like, draw. That, I was always like, whoa.
That part
one
was
day,
kind of
I'll have a cell
funny.
Phone.
That part was kind of funny, and, like, he was, like, fun in his office for a second there. And
yeah,
then he was a monster
I actually
again.
Would have been far more interested in seeing the movie of, like, how Peter Pan gets from Peter Pan to Angry Business Dad. You know? I was like, well, what happened here? Like, that's the movie that I want to see. It's like, what can happen in a Peter Pan's life to make him grow up to be Business Dad?
That would be a really depressing movie. There's a part at the end of the movie where they're in the fight with Captain Hook and Peter Pan, where he's like, you know, this is all a dream. You're going to wake up and you're just going to be Peter Banning, you know, middle-aged, depressed businessman that doesn't care about his family.
He also said that he was going to drink too much. And I was like, whoa, kids movie. That's weird.
Yeah, like it got really real in that moment. He
threatened to kill himself and a few other things where I was like, this is a kids movie?
I mean, he murdered a guy when they were playing baseball. He dropped poisonous scorpions into a box that a human being was in.
Yeah. It's a little weird.
It's pretty intense.
Okay, so why? I mean, I feel like we went over all the reasons why maybe this movie has, like, a bad reputation, but, like, Rob, you seem to know a lot more about it than I did on the way in. Like, are there other things that people hate about this movie?
I'd almost never heard anything specific about why people don't consider this like a worthy Spielberg movie, and I always thought that it was the type of thing where enough people just said it over time and then it just was considered, you know, lesser. But I do recognize all the criticisms that we've been talking about as totally legit, and I think the troubling shooting schedule and all that stuff, like everything that went wrong in the filming of it, it does make sense now that I think back on it. Like, the movie is it's slightly sloppy, and there's a lot of like ADR in it. Like, you could tell, even as a kid, I remember being like, I can never tell what they're saying. Like, the lines, it's like he clearly didn't like work to get the best take every single time. It shows that he kind of was like, his heart wasn't totally in it, and then it just became a burden for him, and he probably just really rushed through it as fast as possible. I did notice that John Williams' score is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Well, apparently they were originally developing it as a musical play.
Whoa.
And that's where the majority, John Williams and whoever he was collaborating with had written all of this music that's never been heard for legal reasons. But they did use some of those motifs from that music in the score of this film.
Do you think that's why they had the little girl randomly sing a song?
Did she sing a song?
She sang a song. I don't even remember if it was a whole song or not. But she started singing, and the little boy was like, oh, that's the song our mom used to sing to us.
Oh, yeah. I vaguely remember that.
That is a good reference. Yeah. I always wondered, what is that song? Is it a real song? Is it written specifically for the movie?
Really fit into the movie. It was, very out of place.
Did they do one of those things where they have a pop star sing it in the closing credits?
I don't know. I turned it off kind of as soon as it was over.
I did.
You're like, get me out of here.
I watched half of the credits.
Here we go. In 1985, composer John Williams and lyricist Leslie Bricusi, I don't know, they worked on Hook being a stage musical, but the project was scrapped after about 10 songs were written. Only one song from the play, When You're Alone, made it into the film. However, many of the play's themes can be heard in Williams' incidental music for the film. So yeah, that was probably that song.
That's
mind-blowing. I'm curious how this would have been as a musical, because when I went back and was watching clips of the stage version of Peter Pan, I love those songs. So for me watching this, something is missing if it's not a musical. Although I get that it's a different, it's a different story.
And when they're staging a musical of Peter Pan in the beginning of the movie.
Oh man, I have so many questions about that.
And those songs are not from the Kathy Rigby one, so maybe that those songs were from the John Williams one.
Oh, maybe.
There's like one song, and I always remember being like, what is this musical? This is not the one that I know.
But so, I feel like this is a little bit of a Spice World situation. Where, like...
In what way?
Not totally. But, like, there's... Like, okay, so they live in a world where Peter Pan is real. Because we know that, because Peter Pan is a character in this movie. But also they're doing a Peter Pan play?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... Does everybody know that Peter Pan is real, or do some people think it's just a play?
No, I think they think it's, like, mostly... Because I think the explanation is that these were stories that they told growing up, and then they were turned into, like, books and plays.
Yeah, right? But, like, when they're going to visit Wendy, the kids are like, is she Wendy from Peter Pan? Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, kind of. Like, yeah. They basically tell the kids that she is Wendy from Peter Pan.
Yeah, because, well, it also has a weird semi tie-in to Finding Neverland, the real story of J.M. Barrie, because he actually did take the story of Peter Pan from the games that, like, the kids used to play that lived next door to him. So I think the movie Hook is trying to say that those kids... were basically like Wendy and her siblings, and that the stories were what J.M. Barrie like turned into the famous Peter Pan stories that everybody knows. But in Hook, it's trying to say like that they actually were going to Neverland and there actually was a Peter Pan. It's pretty weird.
I just thought all of that was really strange.
They say it in like a throwaway line, so... Yeah, it's not explained enough, and it's the kind of thing where I only figured it out like in watching it more recently as an adult.
Yeah, I thought maybe it would take a few more watchings to figure it out.
Well, get on it.
I don't know. I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. I rented it. It's gonna expire. Probably already expired. It's fine.
Fair enough. It's okay.
Well, if it had been a musical, it would have been a great showcase for Phil Collins' cameo, which I was very disappointed wasn't larger. He shows up towards the beginning. He plays the detective that comes to the house.
That's right.
A detective comes to the house? I don't even remember that.
Yeah, after the kids are kidnapped.
I guess that did happen, yep.
Sure. He has a good line. Like, Toodles is like, I've lost my marbles, and he goes, well, one does. It's very British.
Yeah. Apparently, also, Steven Spielberg originally slated the film to be a musical as a vehicle for Michael Jackson in, like, 1983.
Ooh, that's a very different movie.
That's a very, very different movie. But apparently he really wanted to be in a Peter Pan movie.
I want to see that movie. There are so many versions of this movie that you've said out loud that are better.
Yeah. Or at least more interesting, probably. But then Spielberg got distracted making Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And pre-production didn't start until 1989. That's pretty much everything I have to say about this movie. How about you guys?
I'm good. Yeah, me too.
I could do 10 more podcasts about it, but I won't. I will just say that I understand its flaws, and it's just pure nostalgia at this point.
That's okay.
Yeah, we found that most people who pick something really specifically, and like I've found it with myself with things that I didn't even know it would happen with. Like, we've watched a couple of things that Kara was like, you hated this, right? And I was like, I loved every second of it.
That's true. And my inexplicable love of Space World.
Yeah. And, like, how I really liked Growing Pains.
Oh, man. So much. I could probably do a podcast about Spice World. and how it drove me insane because my sister loved it so much.
Mm. Sort of like secondhand nostalgia.
I used to hide the videotape from her. It was terrible.
It's really funny. I had to buy it on DVD because it's not streaming anywhere, so now I own it on DVD.
But you were glad to own it.
Good addition to the collection.
Absolutely. When the revolution comes and all of our streaming platforms dissolve and disappear, I'll be happy that, like, one of the few DVDs I own, one of the few pieces of physical media that I own is Spice World.
Cool.
Oh, one last thing about Hook. Did you see those, like, sniffing flowers? I loved those.
I don't remember them.
And they sneeze?
Yeah. Well, one of them sneezes. There's, like, daffodils. Yeah, I loved those. That was my favorite part of the set. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that does it for this episode of Wistful Thinking. Rob, if people wanted to find you, can they look anywhere?
Yeah. I have an Instagram account, Rob Guizio, G-U-I-Z-I-O. I also have like a music one that I sometimes post stuff on. It's Please Stop Singing Rob. Please is PLZ. I have a band called Policemen and Pickups that some people might like. That's pretty much it.
Cool. Jordan, do you have anything you want to plug?
Zack Attack episode that I was on where we watched The Greatest Showman came out last week. It's very long. Don't listen to the whole thing unless you have 3 hours.
wow.
But I really liked it, being on it a lot. I hated the movie, but
yeah,
I spent
too.
A lot of time while we were recording looking at Zac Efron's abs, and that was good. But I also felt like I got a chance to explain circus to 1.5 people who never had it explained to them really well before. So I enjoyed that part of it. So give a listen if you have a lot of time. And if you want to see my circus tricks, I'm on Instagram at JordoPC.
Yeah. I was on the second episode of Third Time's a Charm, which is Mike Manzi's new podcast, where he is looking at the third movie in different film franchises, and we got to talk about Jaws 3D, which I loved. And have talked about on this podcast several times since I've watched it. So if that has piqued your curiosity, go check out Third Time's a Charm, wherever you got this podcast, and also my other podcast, In Sickness and in Health. Thanks for listening to Wistful Thinking. Find us and all of the other Cage Club shows at cageclub.me. And we'll talk to you next time.
Oh, wait. Can I say one more thing?
Okay.
When I was on Zack Attack, they read emails, and they get emails from strangers. So if you're a stranger, or even just a person that I don't know, or one of my friends that Kara doesn't know, write us an email. It's wistfulpod@gmail.com, right, Kara? Is that our email address?
That sounds right.
Yeah, no, I think that's what it is. Just let us know you exist, because, like, I didn't realize it, but when I was on Zack Attack, I realized that one of my dreams would be for just a stranger to be like, hey, I found you. I like it. Thumbs up. That'd be awesome.
Okay. Maybe say that at the beginning of the podcast next time.
You don't think they listened for an hour and 14 minutes?
Well, just based on my own podcast listening habits, once they, like, start to wrap it up, I usually put on something else. Oh. So.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll do a try again next time.
All right. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming.